What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Kropczyk. John, I don't know if you've taken a lot of meetings in your life. I have, being in a lot of managerial positions. But they say that the worst thing you really can do, and I know I did it many times, is to say, well, I hear you on this, but just to play devil's advocate. And then all of a sudden people look at you and they say, okay, where's he coming from on this? But what I was really surprised to find out from our next guest is that when you say that, you basically are diminishing whatever case you're about to make, because people aren't going to take you that seriously if you're saying, well, don't listen to me, but just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah. Huh. I never thought about it that way, but yeah, because, you know, you want different, you figure you're at a meeting, you want kind of different points of view.
Well, no, you do want that. Now, that's critical. But once you kind of flag the fact that you're suggesting that what you're about to say isn't really heartfelt, thought out, but just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. I could understand that.
So, the book is called In Defense of Troublemakers, The Power of Dissent in Life and Business. And what I learned from doing this podcast and reading this book is that one person committed to an idea, even if that idea is not the one that wins the day in an argument, a dispute, is so important to the good functioning of a company. Because if we're all yes men and yes women, nothing really gets done other than one person's thought. And maybe it's the boss, and maybe the boss doesn't have the best idea in the room.
You're absolutely right. I think you need those dissenting ideas to make things better.
Well, there's a classic example of this that we're going to play for you. And we're going to go back to the 1957 film, 12 Angry Men. Now, if you recall, that was just an incredible film. And there was a jury, and it was presented with what appeared to be a case that had so much overwhelming evidence that a young man had stabbed his father to death that nobody wanted to question it. And as I recall, it was very hot, and they all wanted to get out of there, and they thought it was an open and shut case, until one juror, juror number 8, and we're talking about Henry Fonda's character, disagrees. And it's really a fascinating clip. Let's play this right now.
All those voting guilty, please raise your hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, that's 11 guilty. All those voting not guilty? 1. Right. 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. Well, now we know where we are.
Boy, oh boy, there's always one.
So, what are we doing now?
Well, I guess we talk.
Boy, oh boy.
You really think he's innocent?
I don't know.
I mean, you sat in court with the rest of us. You heard what we did. The kid's a dangerous killer. You could see it.
He's 18 years old.
Well, that's old enough. He stabbed his own father 4 inches into the chest. They proved it a dozen different ways in court. Would you like me to list them for you?
No.
Then what do you want?
I just want to talk.
Well, what's there to talk about? 11 men in here think he's guilty. No one had to think about it twice except you.
I want to ask you something. Do you believe his story?
I don't know whether I believe it or not. Maybe I don't.
So how come you vote not guilty?
Well, there were 11 votes for guilty. It's not easy to raise my hand and send a boy off to die without talking about it first.
Well, now, who says it's easy?
No one.
What, just because I voted fast? I honestly think the guy's guilty. Couldn't change my mind if you talked for 100 years.
I'm not trying to change your mind. It's just that We're talking about somebody's life here. We can't decide it in 5 minutes. Supposing we're wrong.
Supposing we're wrong. Supposing this whole building should fall down on my head. You can suppose anything.
That's right.
Look, what's the difference how long it takes? Suppose we do it in 5 minutes, so what?
Let's take an hour. Ball game doesn't start till 8 o'clock.
Who's got something to say?
I'm willing to sit for an hour.
Great.
I heard a pretty good story last night.
That's not why we're sitting here.
All right, then you tell me. What are we sitting here for?
I don't know, maybe no reason. Look, this kid's been kicked around all of his life. You know, born in a slum, mother dead since he was 9. He lived for a year and a half in an orphanage when his father was serving a jail term for forgery. It's not a very happy beginning. He's a wild, angry kid. That's all he's ever been. And you know why? Because he's been hit on the head by somebody once a day, every day. He's had a pretty miserable 18 years. I just think we owe him a few words, that's all.
I don't mind telling you this, mister. We don't owe him a thing. He got a fair trial, didn't he? What do you think that trial cost? He's lucky he got it. Know what I mean?
No.
Now, look, we're all grown-ups in here. We heard the facts, didn't we? You're not going to tell me that we're supposed to believe this kid, knowing what he is. Listen, I've lived among them all my life. You can't believe a word they say. You know that. I mean, they're born liars.
Only an ignorant man can believe that.
Now, listen.
Do you think you were born with a monopoly on the truth? I think certain things should be pointed out to this man.
Come on, this isn't Sunday. We don't need a sermon.
Come on, we have a job to do now. Let's do it.
Rice Pops. It's a product I work on at the agency. The breakfast with a built-in bounce. I wrote that line.
Very catchy.
Yeah.
Say, do you mind?
Oh, I'm sorry. I have this habit of doodling. It keeps me thinking clearly.
Yeah, we have all this work to do. There's no point staying here forever. Okay. Now, perhaps if the gentleman down there who's disagreeing with us, well, perhaps you could tell us why. You know, let us know what you're thinking, and we might be able to show you where you're mixed up.
Well, look, maybe this is an idea. Now, I haven't given it much thought, but it seems to me that it's up to the group of us to convince this gentleman that he's wrong and we're right. Now, maybe if we each took a couple of minutes just to... Well, it was just a quick idea.
No. That's a good one. Suppose we go once around the table. I guess you're first.
Oh. Well, it's hard to put into words. I just think he's guilty. I thought it was obvious from the word go. I mean, nobody proved otherwise.
Nobody has to prove otherwise. The burden of proof's on the prosecution. The defendant doesn't even have to open his mouth.
So there it was, John. There's Fonda's character, and he really takes unanimity and groupthink, and he tears it apart. And ultimately, they came up with an entirely different verdict than you would have imagined at the beginning.
Yeah, well, I could see how that could happen. I sat on a jury for a day, so it was very interesting. So I could see if you think you got an open and shut case and everybody votes that way and you get one dissenting one, it could throw the whole thing into
Yeah,
chaos.
And I don't think he was apologizing for his thoughts. He was consistent throughout, and his fellow jurors showed that they really admired his belief in justice and proper process, and they ultimately went along with him. But it's not easy to be that person.
No,
it's really
hard.
Not.
That's really hard to do.
Absolutely. But we are trying to give you a little bit of metal, a little bit of steel, and encourage you to become, at times, a troublemaker. Very important. And you think about dissent in our society, John. I mean, we honor those, Patrick Henry and Paul Revere, warning us and telling us something is not right. We have really always been for the underdog in our society. I hope that holds out, because we need dissent, and we need people who are critical of what's going on in terms of authority.
You're absolutely right. We need more dissent right now, more than ever, that we need better ideas on how we're doing things.
Well, I hope you took some Dramamine, because we're going to rock the boat right now. In defense of troublemakers, the power of dissent in life and business. The author is Charlene Nemeth. Charlene Nemeth is with us, and she's got a wonderful new book out called In Defense of Troublemakers. Now, we have a lot of troublemakers in our society. Some are very highly placed. Others, of course, are spread throughout our society. What kind of troublemaker are you talking about?
Well, it's interesting, actually, you mentioned that, because my publisher and I had a bit of a discussion about the title, and I was a little reluctant to have the term troublemaker put in it, because since the book is really about dissent and about authenticity and speaking up, I had much more the image of courage. And I winced a bit at the notion of troublemakers, because it's generally viewed in pejorative terms, you know, as somebody who's an obstacle and just a pain, you know, to deal with. But, of course, they have a better sense of the commercial aspects of this than I do, and like the catchiness of it. But what I find surprising is that almost every interview, and I've had a bunch of them recently, almost start out with a confession of, I'm a troublemaker and I want to understand about it. You know, so apparently the term really does capture people, because we've all been in a position of at least being labeled that way, when in fact what we are trying to do is to speak up and with an authentic voice. And so the book is really about the power and the value, both, of being that authentic dissenter.
And do you feel that that's more difficult for people to do today in many of the corporate cultures and other business alignments?
I do, actually. You know, it's interesting, because sometimes when I've been writing essays about it, particularly for like business journals, they sort of think that business understands the value of dissent, and that essentially they don't need to be persuaded. And I find that nothing could be farther from the truth, because I think what's happened is that they've adopted the rhetoric of welcoming all opinions, and they're aware sort of vaguely of the fact that a challenge to what the boss or the majority or the consensus is, they kind of know that there's a possibility the person might be right, and so they like to think of themselves as tolerant, etc. But the psychological reality of it is that that only lasts for a very short time, if at all. And what you find is that it's still a very strong phenomenon that dissent is suppressed and punished in general. And that's even from, I think, very well-meaning people.
Well, when we go from troublemaker to whistleblower, what kind of movement is that in somebody's thinking? Is it that nobody is going to listen to me, and I don't like what I see going on here, and in fact it may be unlawful or unethical? I mean, how far a stretch is it from being troubled, not being taken seriously, to a whistleblower?
Yeah. Well, the stakes are a lot higher, obviously. I think, you know, in general, whistleblowers really do try to change minds and to alert people to problems within the organization. I mean, what's interesting is many times they're not the people who are disloyal. They're often the people who really love the organization enough that they feel they have to kind of call it out when it's going in the wrong direction. And I think it's usually when that attempt gets thwarted they can't get any place, that then they go outside, essentially, for a voice. But, you know, I'm fond of, I think films many times are wonderful kind of dramatic vehicles for this thing, but I don't know if you've seen the film The Insider with Russell Crowe. It was, you know, essentially...
No, I don't believe I did, no.
It's a wonderful film, by the way. I've got a couple out that I think are great from a psychological dynamics, but it's essentially a whistleblower on the tobacco industry. And he had to go outside, but the film shows the enormous costs. Not only did they come after him, you know, legally and reputationally, which, you know, we're seeing afoot in politics these days as well. I mean, it's terrible costs and what the kind of pain that can be inflicted on people who voice a differing view or one that the powers that be don't want to hear. So, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, I kind of all start to go off in a kind of a different direction.
No, I mean, I do want to talk about another film.
So that even internally, I mean, the guy loses his wife, his family. I mean, there's only so much pressure you can put up with. And I think, you know, a normal discourse, the stakes aren't necessarily that high, but you don't have to look too far in history. And recently, what we were celebrating Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. or even the, you know, Holy Week of Christianity, you know, and martyrs were alive and well back when, too, for the, you know, the opinions that they expressed.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to talk about another film just a little bit later on in our conversation, but I want to go back to those interminable meetings that many of us who have thrived or gotten away from a corporate environment can all too quickly go back to in your own recollection. And that's the person sitting in this meeting, and they really don't want to rock the boat because they can see that there's consensus forming around some idea or thought or movement, and yet they say, but just to play devil's advocate.
Right.
What happens when they say that?
Again, you ask good questions. I'm kind of going in three directions. Let me first back up for a second, is that when we're in those interminable meetings, and all of us, you know, certainly myself included, have been quiet when I know better and don't speak up, but I assume, and everybody else, are part of what's apparently close to 70% of people in companies report that they don't speak up when they see a problem. And basically, the kind of research that looked into that finds that there's really a couple of reasons. One of them is that they think it's not going to make any difference. Namely, they're not going to have any impact. It's not going to change. And secondly, what they are sure of is they're going to be the subject of derision and possibly punishment. So what happens is it's easier just to be silent. And that silence is a real problem because, I mean, not only are we not contributing and speaking up our voice, but we're almost complicit in the consensus. So silence can sometimes look like it's an affirmation of what is being stated more publicly. I think on the devil's advocate thing, to some extent, I think that's sort of a cowardly way out. There are a lot of researchers, you know, authors, business people, whatever, who basically think that that a devil's advocate would have the same stimulating qualities of authentic dissent, but without the grief. So they're always looking for how we can like each other and still manage to get diversity of viewpoints.
Right. Is it a way to qualify what you're about to say? Well, you may not agree with me. That's okay. And then I'll just, you know, go back to being acquiescent. But let me just throw this on the table for argument's sake, and then you can ignore me.
I thought you were actually saying that now you're going to go on to a new topic. I think the real problem is that there's an assumption that you voiced a difference, and so you feel a little bit better about it. And you have the illusion that it's going to actually introduce a new way of looking at things in the other people. The problem is we did several studies on this. It's one of those things that people so took it for granted that would be useful, that they were sort of surprised, that it really doesn't work like authentic dissent. In fact, there's some evidence that you actually bolster the opinion you started with. It does not get you to start thinking outwards in terms of other alternatives. And authentic dissent does do that. You may not like it, but it actually stimulates very broad divergent thinking. And, I mean, that's the power of it. But I think part of the reason why it has such stimulating qualities is that you're arguing with somebody who honestly and authentically believes the position that they're taking. Plus, you're not stupid. You know that they're taking a risk, and they know they're taking a risk in voicing it, and that gives it power.
What is authentic dissent? Meaning, certain people get this sense of being cranky and, you know, kind of disputatious, nagging, and then people look at them, oh, that's just that guy or that gal. I mean, what is authentic dissent that is really accepted as being such?
Well, there's two sides to that. I think what makes it authentic is that the person believes it. And that's very important. So one of the things, for example, we find is that you have to be consistent over time, and you have to speak with some confidence in that judgment, because that's what gives it power if you have a dissenting viewpoint. You can't compromise and wuss around and all of that, because it'll have no impact. I think in terms of how it's perceived as separate, I mean, the first thing authentic, I think, is an intent. It's a commitment, a conviction about the position you're taking. I think the perception of it, though, in spite of its authenticity, will often be derisive. It'll often be, you know, they're stupid or they're immoral or they don't know what they're talking about or they just want attention. But something that's attributing to them some character flaw or motivation, or you think they're an obstacle to getting ahead, and so you just want to kind of get rid of them. Those are motivations to try to ignore them. What's kind of interesting is that if they persist, it actually does get through. I mean, you're not going to acknowledge it. You're not going to tell them they're wonderful. You might not even be nice to them. You might not like them at all. But the fact is, it still has a stimulating quality on how you think, because you're dealing with somebody who does have conviction about what they're saying, and it happens to be different than what you believe. So there's a difference between welcoming it or liking it and simply recognizing that even though the guy's an idiot, you may think, is that he believes what he's saying.
Well, you say, with any break in unanimity, the power of the majority is seriously diminished.
Yeah.
Just one person.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that goes back to the old studies of the 1950s, which have, I think almost everybody knows the conformity phenomenon of Solomon Asch, where basically you can get as few as three people telling you, for example, that clearly unequal lines are equal. I mean, things where you've got factual evidence in front of you, and you know, and if you're alone, you make no mistakes. Mm-hmm. And yet three people who agree on error is that they found in that those early studies about 35% of individuals would actually agree with that erroneous majority. And it isn't just that they were cowing. They actually became confused about reality.
Hmm.
They were making a judgment call that somehow, how can they all be wrong and I'm right? Okay. So there's a powerful phenomenon of consensus. Even back then, and I say back then because it's been heavily replicated in so many ways, but even then, if you have one individual who disagrees with that majority, and they don't even have to agree with you, they can be even more in error than the majority, it liberates you. So you start to know what you know, you see what you see, and you say the truth, which is what you would do if you weren't listening to that majority. So that single dissenter, and as I say, even if the person's wrong, in one study, the guy couldn't even see. I mean, there was some real question about his ability to see, for example, still has that liberating quality. So dissent does, you know, I'm sorry, I'm kind of going into my academic mode, but it liberates us to kind of know what we know. That's one phenomenon. And the second one is it stimulates us to think in more open ways. The downside is that the person doing that, the dissenter, is rarely given credit.
Consensus narrows while dissent opens the mind. I mean, are we generally closed as a psychologist? I mean, do we want to rally around a majority opinion? Do we want to go along, get along? What's our natural desire?
I don't know how natural. I don't think it's built in us, but I think that, oh boy, I think there's probably many layers to that. Some of it may be cultural. But I think we, all around us, we're really advised to go along and get along. We're really advised, partly strategically, not to rock the boat. I can't tell you, my own family members have many times said, why did you get involved? You know, why didn't you just stay out of it and be quiet? Because then, you know, this negative thing happened as a result. And strategically, if you really only think about kind of yourself and what you can gain, you often, you know, you've got more to gain if you aren't in their way, and certainly if you're not speaking to power, truth to power, or you're not challenging consensus, because people don't like it. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think any of us like it, even those of us who fervently believe that we should be open to a differing view. When we hear a challenge to something we really believe, we get irritated. I mean, I think it is partly the human condition to kind of protecting our own ideas, if you will, try to attribute it away or, you know, think that it's foolish, it's not worth our time.
Mm.
So developing a welcoming of it because you know it's something that's important becomes really part of my kind of message you know, it's been a lifelong message.
Oh, absolutely. In some of your early research, you looked at decision-making by juries. And, of course, the movie that I wanted to refer to is 12 Angry Men.
Mm-hmm.
And explain to us what happens in that whole process of deliberation with a jury when you have to reach consensus, and it's not even by majority, it's unanimity.
Yeah, I love that film. You know, it's a dramatic vehicle, and it's often used, like even in business schools or whatever, try to understand how a dissenting voice can win, because ultimately he wins. What the reality of it is that actual juries is that 90% of the time, the verdict of a jury is the position held by the majority on the first ballot. Namely, a minority viewpoint rarely wins. You know, apart from that 90% where the majority on the first ballot wins, maybe, you know, another 6% or so hang, namely that no decision can be made. But the number of times where the minority actually turns it to their position is very, very small. So 12 Angry Men is statistically an infrequent phenomenon in terms of winning at the end. But what really interested me about that film was not just how he changed minds, but really how the quality of the discussion changed as a result of his dissent. So if you look carefully at that film and you start to notice that while he is reluctant to, you know, just hammer and hammer away, and there's some other things we could talk about that I thought were rather ingenious procedural devices in order to kind of break that consensus. But I think the important point is that they start out thinking there's really nothing worth discussing. It's a hot night. They wanted to get to a baseball game. And they had 11 people all agreeing the guy was guilty. There were two eyewitnesses. It was like, what's to talk about? It's a done deal. And they look at Henry Fonda like, well, there's always one. You know, one joker is going to screw this up, you know, just take up time. And so for them, they were also firmly in agreement at the beginning, but as the film unfolds, you begin to realize that as they start to break, is that they start taking into account more facts, more information. They start recreating events and then recognize, for example, that the eyewitness was wrong. They start piecing together different parts of evidence and then coming to a different understanding of what occurred. So what I'm getting at is that in part, you see a reach out to more information. You see them considering alternative ways of thinking about that information. You start seeing them question something they took for granted. And all of those things that I've just mentioned are part of what we know is good decision-making in groups. It's the inverse of groupthink. Stimulated, that whole process is stimulated by a committed, in that case, single dissenter in a group of 12. And I think the film kind of captures that. The film wouldn't work psychologically if it didn't tap something real. So I think it's a great vehicle.
Oh, absolutely. But you're really tough on conventional brainstorming. What's the difference here?
Actually, I'm not tough. I don't think I'm too tough on it. I think what it really is that I have an eye for assumptions that go untested. And my inclination is to test it. And, you know, so one of the inclinations is that everybody says that, you know, getting along and cohesion is the underpinnings of good group functioning. And that just makes intuitively good sense. But you know it has a downside. So I've spent a lot of time looking at that downside of consensus. I think in terms of brainstorming, when Osborne came up with the brainstorming, and he had specific rules for brainstorming, it's not just, you know, sitting around and kind of, spouting off whatever comes to mind. There were specific rules like aim for quantity of ideas. Don't worry about the quality. Build on each other's ideas. But one of them I always paid attention to, and I think you'll realize why, is do not criticize. And again, it's one of those that sounds intuitively plausible. Like you think, well, if somebody criticizes your idea, you'll just shut down. And so that looks like that can't be good for creative generation of ideas. I never really believed that because just like the devil's advocate in a way, these things seem very contrived to me. They seem to be the inverse of creative and open thinking. And particularly since I'd studied the power and value of dissent so much, is that I knew that there was value in ideas being challenged. And so basically what we did is we did a study on brainstorming. We did it both in the U.S. and in France, by the way, exact same study.
Mm-hmm.
And I sent over all the materials to some colleagues in France to do it there. And we really just compared two sets of kind of rules, the traditional ones, and then the other condition, we changed the rule of do not criticize to essentially, having them welcoming debate, even criticism. And the bottom line of it is that everybody would have predicted that opening it up to criticism would have meant that they would have not generated hardly any ideas, and the reverse was the case. They generated even more ideas than the traditional brainstorming instructions, and it was true both in France and in the U.S. And one side thing that you might find kind of amusing, I remember when I published that, the editor and I had this discussion, interaction between us, because he kept wanting to know what the hypothesis would be if France and the U.S. were different. And I basically said, well, number one, you can't talk at that level of cultural, you know, without getting stereotypic and, you know, talking about things you don't understand. The reason I did it in two countries is that my feeling was is that if the phenomenon replicated, we got the same findings in two countries, it would really make me feel very solid grounds about the findings. And the reason he found it so surprising is that most studies aren't even replicated in a person's own lab, much less in a different lab, say within the U.S., much less to try to do it abroad unless they're looking for a cultural difference. And so one of the things I think that's a handicap in research is that often studies are not replicated. But he couldn't understand why anybody would take the chance of doing the same study in two countries looking for that the hypothesis would hold up regardless. And it was sort of an interesting discussion about the nature of the way science is done as well. But as it turned out, the findings held up in both countries, and so I felt there was it was pretty solid. But of course it flew in the face of a time-worn assumption that for half century everybody's been waxing and waning about the importance of don't criticize, and that they believe encourages creative problem solving. Now, maybe there's some truth to it. I think, brainstorming, I'm sure, can be choreographed and done well, depending on the circumstances. But what I don't believe is that this notion that you should have all these rules about, what you can and can't say and whether or not you're challenging or criticizing someone, I don't think that encourages creativity, basically.
How does a society like China, where we think that there isn't a lot of dissent and politically it's not at least openly allowed, here in the United States, even though many of our corporate cultures seem to be closed off to dissent, yet we as a nation continue to amend our Constitution, add new rights that were denied in the past. I mean, we would seem to have that ability for minority rights to come forward over a period of time, and yet the Chinese seem to be innovative in many ways and curious. Explain to us what you think is going on there, and is there a relationship between the way we dissent in small groups and our larger political culture?
Oh, well, now you're taking me out of my comfort zone. But we're having a conversation, so
sure.
I just give the caveat that, it stretches into an area that I isn't completely within my area of expertise, but I certainly, reflect on these things. And I have given talks certainly over in Singapore, and I've spoken to groups like of Chinese MBAs who've come here to the States. I probably can't talk really intelligently so much about the cultural differences, but I do worry about, I don't change my mind about the theories related to creativity. And I do still think that it's very, very important to have an open airing and expression of views and to not only tolerate but to welcome challenge and dissent. Having said that, I don't know that China does have that. And it's a question also of what you call creativity, is that many times creativity can be adopting someone else's ideas and perfecting them or making them more efficient or making them cost less.
Which they're often accused of doing.
Yeah, that's right. And the Japanese were accused of that, too, mm-hmm. certainly for many years, too. And, you know, one would really question whether that's truly creativity as opposed to a logical extension more akin to problem solving, which could still have a lot of value and certainly be financially profitable. But one would question whether or not it's really creativity per se.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, my book is going to be translated into Chinese, both the simple and complex forms of Chinese, with two separate publishers over there. So the Chinese have a lot of interest in these issues, and I think they're thinking and trying to be open to how they can capitalize on their newfound wealth in many ways, too, in terms of an economic engine. I found, too, a couple of years ago, I spent a couple of weeks over in Tokyo at their invitation. It's a strategic management group there. And there's a lot of interest because they see their society as being too entrenched in terms of the ways they've always done things. So they're very open to thinking about these things. Changing them is very difficult. I think we have one small advantage, which I sometimes worry is being eroded on a day-by-day basis, by the way, and that's that we've always had built in a notion of checks and balances. I mean, even our legal system is quite different than most other countries, most of whom don't even have juries. They don't even have citizen participation, you know, in justice. But we have an adversarial system. And so kind of built in is that notion that essentially out of even two untruths is that if we really debate it long enough, truth will win out. And so I think we've got things going for us, and I worry when those balances are being eroded.
Let me ask you in closing. You talk in one chapter about diversity in groups, and we've paid a lot of attention to gender and color and experience and the like, but have we paid enough attention to the diversity of ideas and opinion as opposed to people who may be different from one another but not express different opinions?
Yes, that's perfect. I mean, that's the best synopsis of one little section, actually, in the book that I tried to kind of convey, because I didn't want to go into the whole diversity literature. But the bottom line of it is where diversity really helps performance and good ideas is when it's a difference of opinion. And what happens is people tend to assume that when you come in different demographic categories, it's going to be a different perspective. So they assume, you know, if you've got Democrats and Republicans, or you've got men and women, or you've got, you know, old and young, whatever, that you will almost by definition have different perspectives on the table. And I wish it were that easy, but it's not. And one of the things I'm fond of doing in class, I think I may have put this example in the book, is that I often show them like the cabinet members of both Obama and of Bush or Trump, or you can take any example of any president. And sometimes what you'll see, I mean, these days they're not worried quite so much about even the face of diversity. But in general, you'll see that there's an attempt to have, you know, men and women and people from different ethnicities or colors or whatever. But the fact is that they're all ideologically the same. They're chosen for their loyalty to the position in power. And so it becomes kind of a very quick and visual representation of the fact that you can have lots of demographic diversity and still have homogeneity of viewpoint. And that's the recipe for groupthink. It is not the recipe for engaged debate and good decision-making. So I think it's really important to pick for the relevant perspective, the differences in perspective when you're putting together your groups. Now, there are other reasons for diversity. I mean, some of them have to do with social justice and having everybody at the table, but that's a separate reason for diversity of demographic. Just from the point of view of the quality of the decision-making, it has to translate into the differing viewpoints. So, I mean, you're exactly right, you know, in terms of pointing that out.
All right. Well, Charlon Nemeth, I've got to thank you so much for being with us. A fascinating conversation that I don't think many people really have stopped to consider. In Defense of Troublemakers, The Power of Dissent in Life and Business. Thanks again for your incredible research and your time today on America Trends.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for calling.